This is a specially set Senate Committee on the Judiciary hearing. We are set to hear one matter, which is AB 465 by Assemblymember Eggman. Let's go ahead and establish a quorum. No, we need one more. We need one more. But if we could call and hope that Assemblymember Eggman's available, that will be helpful. There's another committee coming in after we are concluded, so I'd like to try to get going. Please come join us. Happy to have you. I do believe we're one short of a quorum, and I know that Senator DeRosa was in the hall. So if we could have her come join us, we'll have a quorum. Right now we'll start as fantastic. All right. Madam Secretary, please help us establish a quorum. Please call the roll.
Jackson.
Here.
Jackson here. Borges. Durazo.
Here.
Durazo here. Gonzalez.
Here.
Gonzalez here. Jones. Monning.
Here.
Monning here. Stern. Umberg. Wieckowski.
Here.
Wieckowski here.
All right. We do have a quorum. May I inquire, are we expecting our Republican colleagues to join us?
Yes.
Any problem with us proceeding now? Usually we like to extend that courtesy.
Please proceed.
All right, very good. So we have one matter before us. I want to remind everyone that for that measure, we will abide by the policy we have in this committee that there will be two main witnesses, 2 minutes each for support, and similarly, two main witnesses, 2 minutes each in opposition. Anyone else who wishes to express their opinion will call upon those in addition in support to please come to the microphone, give your name and affiliation only, and then we'll do the same thing after the opposition two witnesses. If there are, you don't have to, we don't need to go on forever, but we certainly invite those who are here to express their opinions at the appropriate time. So with that, Assemblymember Eggman, you have AB 465. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank all of you for taking the time to hear this bill today and to the committee for working on it. I know oftentimes bills introduced in the second house can be time-consuming for people and unexpected, but I do appreciate the work that's gone into this. I'm presenting AB 465, a bill to better protect survivors of domestic abuse from gun violence. AB 465 would codify two existing California rules of court that establish a judicial oversight process for courts to ensure that firearm relinquishment in domestic violence restraining order cases actually take place. It would make this process consistent throughout California. It would also align the civil rules language with the criminal rule, which mandates these processes and requires an expedited review period. In California, 33% of women and 27% of men experienced some form of domestic violence in their lifetime. And in 2018, there were over 166,000 domestic violence-related calls for assistance across the state of California. Over 45% of those calls reported some type of weapon being used in the incident. We also know that the possession of a firearm, anytime there's violence occurring, increases the risk of homicide by at least 500%. In fact, over half of the domestic violence victims have been killed with a firearm. Every month, an average of 52 women are shot and killed in the United States by an intimate partner. And there are nearly 1 million women alive right now in the United States who have been shot at or shot by an intimate partner. Even with our state's robust firearm legislation, there are still over 23,000 armed prohibited persons who have failed to relinquish their weapons. Of those 23,000, 18% become a prohibited person due to a restraining order. Under existing law right now, when a person becomes a subject of a domestic violence restraining order, they automatically become a prohibited person who are required to relinquish any and all firearms and ammunition within their possession or control within 24 hours. The two rules of court intended to support this goal have been implemented on a limited and oftentimes inconsistent basis across California. In the civil context, this is especially concerning because the only judicial officer with knowledge of the firearm relinquishment process is the judge, and the survivor who filed for the restraining order is often self-represented. So when somebody gets a restraining order, by law, they are required to relinquish their firearms within a certain amount of time and present evidence that they have done so. Oftentimes, when women go before, when the judge is seeing them for the first time, they are not represented. So they may not know to even ask. And the judge, they're very busy, oftentimes don't ask, have you relinquished your firearms? Is there proof of that? That's the issue that we're trying to solve right now, that is not standard across. It is already required that they give up their guns, but that right now there is no process to check to see if they have or have not, leaving it up oftentimes to the victim of that violence to be able to tell the judge, you need to ask them for their firearms. That shouldn't be. So that's what this bill would do, would just say that the first time that person comes before the judge, that they ask them then, have you relinquished your arms, and is there some kind of proof of that? With me here today, this bill is supported by the California DA's Association, the Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence, the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence, and the California Police Chiefs Association. With me today to answer questions you may have about the process is Allison Kephart, the Director of Legal Services at Weave, who represents survivors of domestic violence in court at no cost.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I am Allison Kephart. I am the Director of Legal Services with Weave. Y'all can hear me a little bit better. I am the Director of Legal Services with Weave. And as Assemblymember Eggman noted, I am here to answer any questions this committee may have about the process that survivors of domestic violence go through, in particularly in family court.
Are there any other witnesses here in support of this measure? Any witnesses in opposition? Good afternoon. Please proceed. 2 minutes if you would.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairwoman. This is Tracy Kenny. I'm an attorney with the Judicial Council, and I actually have the privilege of staffing the Family and Juvenile Law Advisory Committee for the Judicial Council, which would be charged with implementing this legislation were it to be enacted. So I just wanted to share some of the concerns that that committee had about how we would go about implementing this legislation, because we don't think that it is ready to go forward in the way it is, and we aren't even sure how to implement some of it because of the ambiguities, and we also think there would be serious unintended consequences if it were to be enacted in this form. And it is not that we don't take these issues very seriously. This is a committee that's chaired by two very folks who are very interested in ensuring that domestic violence victims are protected, that our orders are enforced. We think that is a laudable goal and one that we would like to sit down with other stakeholders and try to figure out the most effective means to do that in a time period that allows us to get the details right, because these are courts that have very high volumes and there are a lot of people seeking protection. And if we add a huge volume of new hearings in which potentially no one even shows up because the service requirements are very vague. So email service may result in the restrained person not even getting service of the hearing. So you have a review hearing on firearms in which you have very little information. So for example, when a person seeks a protective order, there is a question on the temporary restraining order request form. Do you think that the restrained person has a gun? And you say yes, no, or I don't know. So the court may have a form that has a checkbox. I don't know. That's the evidence that the court has to make these specific and detailed findings of fact that are required by this proposed legislation. I'm not even sure what on the revised form for the court to then try to determine, do they have a gun or not? Do they make a finding that they have a gun or not make a finding that they have a gun? Do they set a review hearing in that case? Is it in 2 days? And if no one shows up to that review hearing, what is the court expected to do? There are requirements to communicate with the local law enforcement agency with jurisdiction over the restrained person. I'm not sure what that means. Which is the local law enforcement agency with jurisdiction over me or you? How is the court to, who that is? Who in that entity is the court to communicate with? That's not specified in the legislation. But fundamentally, I think that in terms of getting guns from restrained parties, we have an incredibly great model in San Mateo County that has the potential to be expanded to more of the state, where their sheriff's office looks at all of these restraining orders as they come in, and any one where it says yes, or even I don't know, they are calling the restrained party, they're checking up on them, they're checking the databases to see if they have registered firearms, and they are getting the surrender of many, many, many firearms. Great. I think this is the way to protect people, not to load our court calendars.
Thank you for your testimony, and I think that may give us some guidance going forward. Thank you for your testimony. Next witness.
Our comments really align with the Judicial Council, so I'll keep my testimony brief. But as was said, first and foremost, I want to emphasize that the relinquishment of firearms by restrained persons should be a priority, and the courts play a big role in that. But we need a thoughtful solution, and as written, AB 465 is not that. AB 465 either has too many teeth because of separation of power issues, embroilment issues and due process concerns, or not enough teeth because there's no bench warrants, no explicit contempt, and no duty of law enforcement to investigate. Because of the last-minute consideration of this bill, many questions have been raised, but no answers provided. And as the Judicial Council just brought up, one such question is, will this bill actually result in more gun relinquishments? The discussion that we are having is a worthy one, and one that CJA is not only willing to engage in, but is eager to engage in the fall, so that we can have a more thoughtful discussion and find the best way to protect these protected persons. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Other witnesses in opposition? Seeing none, well, let's bring it back to the dais. I appreciate our articulation of the issues associated with implementation. I am, though, struck by the fact that we really do need to start addressing this problem. I know, having listened this morning at the in public safety, the story about individuals, primarily women, but not necessarily exclusively, who are at risk and who have been murdered and whose children have either witnessed or been murdered as well. And I had a similar situation in my own district a number of years ago, for which I then brought legislation. This is a problem that seems to keep growing. I have discussed this with the author, who is more than willing to continue to tighten this up. I wasn't aware of the San Mateo model, but I suspect that it's one that we can pursue going forward. So I want to commend the author. I do want to move the bill forward so that we can insist on sort of putting the knee in everyone's back, whether it's the Judicial Council, and I serve on that, so I know they will do a very comprehensive effort to bring this matter to some kind of doable process. And being the spouse of a retired judge who sat on the CJA, I understand the concerns associated with the courts, who are clearly overwhelmed, particularly in family law courts. There may be some other ways we can do this. I keep thinking, you know, the private sector knows just about everything about us. Why can't we in the public sector, in the public safety sector, have the kind of systems in place where a court can issue a restraining order? I'm thinking, you know, you don't even have to know that a person has a gun. You just simply say, a restraining order has been issued. If this person has firearms, they must be relinquished. It goes to law enforcement. They check if the app system was actually functioning properly. They could find it out in a heartbeat. They could have a designated a portion of law enforcement that would make sure those guns were relinquished. I mean, this could be done if we really put our minds to it, and certainly would save a lot of lives. So I want to commend the author. It's an urgent issue, and certainly gotten amends and what have you, and not the favored way of doing things here. But, you know, that and $2, you can get your coffee in the morning. Or is it $3 now? But anyway, you know, I think this is a very important issue, and I want to thank you for bringing it forward. Questions, comments? Senator Wieckowski?
Yeah. Can we direct our attention to page 8 within the staff analysis that goes on? Because we talk about codification of the court rules, but we're also expanding it to TROs. And we know that, as the staff analysis says, the TROs, there's no notice to this person. So it's one thing, it's emergency, but it's one thing to say, a stay away, I get an order, and then the sheriff will serve them. It's another thing to say that they've got 2 days to get rid of all their guns and relinquish them. How do you take care of that problem without notice?
Without notice? Well, I mean, I think the chair has pointed out, I would take some offense that this hasn't been a thoughtful approach. I think it's been a thoughtful approach, and it comes with some urgency. And I have certainly said that we will continue to work on this until we can get all the issues resolved to take it forward. I don't think anybody argues that people who have been committing abuse should be able to keep their guns, but I understand the issue that it would be hard then to notice them and to have that process in place. So
yeah, it's the due process. You know, they may be bad actors, they may be violent, they may have unregistered. All that may be true, but at least when we do bills, we want to make sure that the backstop is the due process, that we've all trained in the law to say you've got to give that person notice before they're quote unquote in violation of this new statute for just possessing. Not that they, I mean, maybe the incident you'll have. Your witness has said here that there's incidents of a 500% increase in murders and violence. I got that. But still, we're a state of rules, that have to be followed.
Senator, I don't think that, and I totally agree, and we have fought very hard in this committee to make sure due process and notice and all those fundamental constitutional rights are maintained. I don't think that the judges and that the judicial council would allow any kind of proceeding without that inherent due process. That's the, we've sort of got a roadmap here, and the suggestion, and I know having talked to the assembly member, she will continue to fill this in with the assistance, and I think there is a desire to collaborate with the courts and with others. Again, this is a framework. And I don't think, frankly, there's a court that I can think of that would find someone in criminal contempt or would have any kind of criminal or even in a civil court, any kind of consequence without that notice requirement. That's just a fundamental constitutional right. So it's you could argue, I think, that it's implicit in this because it is so fundamental, but certainly working on this going forward to make it as clear as possible, I think, is something that's sort of a fundamental part of this discussion.
So how would that happen?
If I can just pop in to try to help clarify. Let me scoot this so you guys can hear me. The intention, I believe, behind the language is not to find somebody in violation before they've received notice. But the existing rules already about firearm relinquishment direct that once a restrained person has been served with the temporary order, so they've been given notice, that is when they have 24 hours to relinquish their firearms and 48 hours to file a form, a judicial counsel with the form, confirming that they have done so, that they have complied with that rule. So we're not, the intention behind this is not to hold somebody, you know, in contempt of a court order when they're not aware of that court order. As Madam Chair pointed out, that's the goal. The reason that one of the reasons to include TROs as part of this is, for example, a TRO may be issued in the family court setting on an ex parte basis. And then the parties may come to the first noticed hearing. And let's say, for example, they come to that hearing and it gets continued for some reason before it's heard on the merits. The TRO is reissued at that point. It's continued. So we wanted to try to close a possibility where you might have a continuance of a temporary restraining order, but you haven't dealt right there at that first hearing where both parties have been noticed and have appeared with the party has relinquished their firearms, because the earliest point in the process we can address this, the safer we make victims, their family members, and the community at large, including our peace officers.
One of the joys of, again, legislation that comes in late, there's no opportunity to make amendments, but I think it's just fundamental that they have to have notice. I mean, and that I think would be a requirement in any court. If it isn't spelled out, it will get spelled out. But I think, as was mentioned,
the notice, right.
Once you get the order,
restraining order, you get the order. It says on.
And on an ex parte, I mean, you have to serve the person. That's the requirement in any ex parte proceeding, that you can get it without their being present, but then you have to serve them. The challenge here, frankly, and I think it's something we're going to have to work on, is in a family law matter, we know that most family law litigants are in pro per, meaning they don't have a lawyer. And that's a challenge. But we do have judges, and hopefully we will be able to create some rules and some procedures where the courts will recognize that we're giving them a little bit more work to do, but this will save lives, and I think that's part of the urgency of this item. Senator Umberg.
So if you'll indulge my newness, tardiness, and ignorance, I'd be grateful. I heard what the Judicial Council and Judge Association had to say. I also recognize the urgency of the issue. I also recognize that it's held over till January, but if we had an urgency clause and passed it in January, I realize that delays it for 3 months. But there does seem to be some ambiguity that needs to be resolved.
I think, you know, moving forward now and then in January and having time over the break to continue to work, it needs to still go back to the other house and to the floor. Right. There is still time to get these issues rectified, I think. And then you're right, with an urgency clause, it could be law sooner. Because, again, if we don't get it started, then we just have longer to wait in January to start the whole process again. And I shared in public safety, I had an issue in my district just a week and a half ago, and we all know about the young police officer who was shot and killed by somebody who should have relinquished their firearms. And I had just a case in my district a week and a half ago where somebody was, a person with a restraining order showed up at somebody else's home, a school teacher. The whole school had to get shut down, and the perpetrator ended up being shot and killed because he pointed the gun at the police when they showed up. It has impacts that reverberate across a community, and especially low-income communities of color, where people are more likely not to have an attorney with them when they show up.
All right. Well, that answers my question. So you're going to put it over. It's going to go over till January. And
we're moving, if we move forward today, and then we'll have time to pick it
but
back.
But then, and you're considering adding an urgency clause.
Yes.
All right. Thank you.
One final question. I appreciate that insight into the process. It's a tragic situation and a major gap. I'm just trying to drill down. Is the judicial council or the judges concerned about due process or resource? It seems like there's two things being talked about here, because what I'm hearing is the notice requirement and the due process issues seem to be fulfilled under the existing service, but is the concern more about what the sort of ancillary procedures would be and what that would trigger administratively, more so than the underlying constitutional concerns?
There are also due process concerns. For example, there's no current authority in the law to serve someone by email. That is not considered a valid method of service. This legislation would be the first bill to enact without someone providing consent specifically to that type of service and supplying that email themselves, a way that you would notice someone of a legal proceeding in which they might be held in contempt of court and subject to criminal proceedings by email at their, quote, last known email address. That is not something that's been set forth. That is a serious due process concern we have. What do we do if the person says, well, I served him by email, the person doesn't show up at the hearing? You know, should the court be holding that person in contempt? Should they be subjecting them to sanctions? Those are serious concerns. In addition, we are concerned that there will be a volume of this, and the ambiguity and confusion lead to a lot of unnecessary proceedings because there isn't clarity about when this happens, and extra time in proving the negative that someone doesn't have a firearm based on the findings language.
I don't want to work against myself here, but we do have legislation, I believe, that's passed both houses that looks at digital service process. And I mean, you can tell when someone's read an email. So I hope it's something that you guys start to look into. But
we do have procedures in place. We just don't have something like this where it is just without the typically, and it's been at the legislature's requirement that it is at the consent of the person being served, that we want people to opt into email service before we take away their right to traditional service.
Okay, thank you for the indulgence. Thank you for bringing this forward to seminar.
Yes, Senator DeRosa.
Yeah. I just want to ask, in terms of the specific process, there is a form that's used, right? If you could just explain the process of when a firearm, they're expected to turn in their firearms, because there's a form of proof of firearms turned in, sold, or stored. Mm-hmm. So I'm still a little confused as to when the problem occurs that we're trying to correct. Mm-hmm. Because that form exists. Mm-hmm. Who uses it? When is it used?
It's being...
Go ahead. Thank you. Yeah, I'm happy to address that question. And I'm sorry that I can't quite look at you and talk into the microphone at the same time. So in terms of the process, yes, there is a form. I believe it's DV-800. It's a statewide judicial council form that the restrained party is supposed to use in order to notify the court that they have complied with the relinquishment requirement. And they're supposed to include with that a receipt proving that they turned the firearms into either law enforcement or to a licensed gun dealer. It's not being used, is the reality. In domestic violence restraining order cases, once the restrained party is served with notice of the hearing and the restraining order, there is language in the temporary restraining order that advises them that they need to relinquish their firearms, that they need to do it within 24 hours, that they need to fill this form out. They're just not doing it. They're not complying for whatever reason, whether it's because they just don't want to, they don't believe that they need to abide by the court's order, or because they simply don't read the restraining order paperwork. And so they
they just don't comply.
And when is this form supposed to be?
And that's what this would do. It's already supposed to be submitted, but when then the two parties go before the judge, this just asks the judge to ask, did you turn in that paperwork? Do you have that proof? Mm-hmm. That's just the missing link that we're asking for. The law already exists that they are supposed to do that. But if nobody asks the person, and the judge is the backstop in that case, that's who they're going before.
So this is a form that will help them prove
mm-hmm.
that they correct. Turned in. So then what's the problem? Maybe the judge.
The challenge is we turn if the court has knows that they have a gun, then the rule does advise the court at a hearing. The question is there's lots of situations in which you have no idea if the restrained person has a firearm. So you're setting a hearing for somebody who isn't going to read the paperwork in the first place, and you expect that they're going to read the thing that you sent them about the hearing, and then you're going to hold a hearing. If they don't read it, they're not going to come, and then the court is holding a hearing with no one before them because the protected person is not actually required to be at that hearing to do, you know, to ask if the thing has been relinquished. There's been a lot of talk about when the parties are in court. I think if this legislation were limited to the times when the restrained person is actually appearing before the court, that the court had to make an inquiry and follow up on that, it would be far less concerning for us than when it applies in every single case.
I think
them.
That, though, that's a discussion. The problem is that if people don't want to acknowledge and recognize that we have a court process and a court system, we don't want to reward that behavior. I mean, the truth of the matter, the real problem is that 85% of family law litigants go into court and they have no idea what they're doing because they can't afford a lawyer. And although there are some courts that have self-help programs that really can be of assistance, but that isn't the issue here. The issue is how do we get people who should not, who have demonstrated the propensity to violent behavior, who have firearms, to remove those firearms from their possession? Because we know, as those staggering numbers indicated, over half of the victims, murder victims, half the women who were murdered mm-hmm. in this country are murdered by an intimate partner who kills them with a firearm. It's thousands of people. I mean, it's so if we can remove those firearms, that's the ultimate goal. I think that's why we're here. That getting through that process in a way, understanding that some people are just not going to comply, and that's what we're trying to do. On the other hand, there are people who don't know what they're reading. Is it in a language they understand? Does the court know? Can we try to set up some procedures so that the court can then notify law enforcement? I mean, there are lots of questions, but this bill will at least force us to get those questions before the Judicial Council, before the CJA, so that we can get some answers, and also before the public defender and other agencies, which might have their own thoughts on how to accomplish this goal. Any other questions? Well, that's right. You can move. We have a motion, Senator.
I'm sorry. Just a quick question. I missed the bouncing ball between Senator Umberg and Assemblywoman regarding coming back next year with the urgency clause. I understood Senator Umberg's comments to mean we're going to keep the bill here and come back in January, but I didn't know if that's. If somebody could just explain what we're doing in January versus what we're doing today.
Would you like to? My understanding, the bill would move forward out of this committee. It would be then re-referred to the next place where then we would hold it and work on it until January when we all come back to session. All through the break, we'll all be working together. We have a very firm commitment from other parties to work on this bill. The Attorney General's office has reached out to us also and said that they would like to engage on this. So we think, you know, with a little bit more time, we'll get it just right. And then with an urgency clause, be able to close it out early next year and make it law.
So not intending to bring it to the Senate floor in the next couple of days. Okay, great.
Well, I think we have a problem there because the motion is due pass to the Senate floor.
We can hold it there.
We could hold it there. All right. So is that your desire?
It would be my desire.
All right. So we have a motion to pass to the Senate floor. We have agreement from the Assembly member to work with all the stakeholders. I think we all want the same thing. It is complicated by certain differences. Trying to apply a criminal process to a civil matter, where in the civil matter you likely don't have counsel, whereas in the criminal matter you do. But we got to figure out a way to get this resolved. So would you like to close?
No, just I think the discussion has is proceeding along. As I think the chair in the last committee said, as a woman, I am most likely to be murdered by somebody in an intimate relationship than anything else. We need to do something about that. I don't think it's too hard for us to solve. I think we just need to roll up our sleeves and be able to solve.
Thank you. All right. Madam Secretary, the motion is due pass to the Senate floor. Please call the roll.
Jackson?
Aye.
Jackson, aye. Borges? Durazo?
Aye.
Durazo, aye. Gonzalez?
Aye.
Gonzalez, aye. Jones?
Aye.
Jones, aye. Monning?
Aye.
Monning, aye. Stern?
Aye.
Stern, aye. Umberg?
Aye.
Umberg, aye. Wieckowski? Wieckowski, aye. 8-0.
8-0. That measure passes. Thank you, and we are adjourned.